And away we go. It's good to be with you. Want to begin by reminding us all, reminding myself first and most of all, that when we gather in this part of the world, we gather on Treaty 1 territory. Treaties to which we are not signatories necessarily in the material sense, but participants. We are named as groups in those agreements, and we have obligations to them. That's important to remember. And if you're somewhere else physically, I would encourage you to pay attention, if you haven't already, to what treaty you are a party to, where you are, and what some of the implications of that might be for how you and those around you think about land and place and connection and responsibilities and that kind of that whole bundle. Let's take a few moments to breathe together. If you're new to the community, or this isn't a practice that you choose to participate in or that you're comfortable with, just know that that's as fine as can be. And don't worry about it. Go get yourself some coffee, take a bathroom break, whatever, and come back. But for those of you who are participating, Judy, your song, Breathe Deep. I'm not saying this to, how can I even say this? I want to talk about something I really enjoy in a qualitative way without diminishing other things. Is this even possible? I was going to say something like, you don't choose any songs that I like better than the songs that you write, honestly, which isn't to say the other songs aren't sometimes also ones I very much enjoy personally, but the songs that come out of your story, Judy, feel like they have a unique depth to them in the context of our friendship and your friendships in this community and contributions. So Breathe Deep is a favorite, is the short sentence. And some of the imagery that I sort of just really felt like I was leaning into in that song this morning was about our feet on the ground and how each breath gives us, you know, this place where we are. We're going to be exploring things that are all tied into this morning, but how this place, reality is the word we're going to use, where we are, is still giving us everything we need. And we're going to explore some of the ways in which that might not always be the case if we stay on the paths we're on collectively as a species. And that's an interesting and challenging intersection as well. A reason to both pay attention to the future in a unique way and to the present, but also to be grateful for this moment, this one we know we have because we're in it. So find somewhere where you can sit, if that's an option that's available to you. I personally, if I had my way, I'd be laying flat on my back on the floor when we do this. That's my favorite posture for breath. But I'm not going to do that in this moment. So somewhere where you can sit comfortably, your feet flat on the floor, a sense of connection to physical place, where you are, how the chair feels under your seat, how the feet feel, your feet feel on the floor. Rest your hands in your lap so they're at ease, and let the, if there's tension in them that you can tell when you stop and pay attention, then let that go. Just open them up and let your hands breathe too. And we'll take a few moments to breathe together. Let's breathe, if you're participating, so in through your nose for a count of four and relax your tummy and just fill your whole self up with the breath of life, and then cradle that breath as the gift that it is for a count of seven, and then out through your mouth like you were blowing out a candle, so with some, so you can hear it, for a count of eight, empty right out. And let's do three rounds of that. There's an interesting sort of yogic position for your tongue if you want to try this. It won't get into the sort of understandings that go with it necessarily, but if you place your tongue on this ridge right behind your front teeth like that, throughout, it helps sort of connect some other dots, if you will. All right, let's breathe together. So three rounds and then on we go. Let's breathe. Peace, everybody. So here's a question for you. Do you ever fantasize about a life role or a job that is nothing like the one you have now? And I realize it could be an easily misunderstood opening remark. So just to be abundantly clear, I personally feel quite delighted to be part of what we get to do at the table together. And so this is not about that for me personally. But I feel like I've had a number of these conversations over the years. And in particular, I can clearly remember my father-in-law talking about how when he retired, he wanted to just drive one of those gigantic, you know, front deck mowers at the golf course. He just wanted to cruise around in the sunshine all day, making those already perfectly groomed lawns look even better. That was what he dreamed about. I was chatting with someone else recently who was talking about the experience of being burnt out on people work and how they were fantasizing about getting a job driving a dump truck because it just felt so concrete. You get in the truck, you go here, you fill up with dirt, you go there, you dump out the dirt, you do it again, however many times fit in your day, and then you turn off the truck and you go home and you're done. Usually, in those kind of fantasies, nothing breaks down. The dump truck never gets stuck. You never back it into a brand new house. The lawn is never a muddy bog covered in mosquitoes. You don't have a boss that's a jerk. That's why they're called fantasies, right? Our ability to find perspectives or ideas or fantasies that kind of, you know, take the pressure off in some way is actually pretty remarkable. We have powerful imaginations, and this is one of the ways we sometimes use them to cope. And that can, on some occasions, be both necessary and helpful. But it can also go off the rails pretty easily and pretty badly if we lose our grip on what's real and what's not. The line between reality and fantasy is an important one. So reality, as we've been exploring, is what is not all that amenable to our fantasies or our dreams or our desires. Reality is the part that doesn't acquiesce to our whims. Now, that said, we interact with reality, and not just as victims, but more on that as we go, because that's a complicated relationship, complicated set of ideas. I heard Finnish from Finland, just in case that didn't translate well through the internet. I heard a Finnish folk saying this past week, which in translation says, "The dogs are barking, but the train keeps going." Some nice rural imagery there, right? I mean, clearly this is not a bullet train, at least not in the picture that I got in my imagination when I heard it. And maybe that's because I grew up in a small northern town where the train was an important feature, kind of went right through town. And it slowed down enough so that the local dogs could actually kind of meaningfully run alongside it barking for a bit. It wasn't like bark, you know, they could kind of, there's an extended experience of this in my imagination. So metaphorically though, not to make too much of that, in the context of our exploration today, the train in that saying is reality. We would be the dogs. So bark, bark says us. And kind of, yeah, whatever, says reality, and it just keeps on moving along. Now, saying like that, understood that way, could rub us the wrong way, because we can tell that we have a lot of agency. And compared to many periods of history, those of us that have the privilege of living in this part of the world, perhaps uniquely, in the early parts of this century, could perhaps be forgiven that assuming that whatever problems come along, we'll find a solution. Might take a while, might be a bit of a rough ride, but we'll get there. But once in a while, something happens that gives us a bit of a whack in the side of our hubristic heads, and we slow down long enough to consider that even in the midst of all that we have to be amazed at and grateful for, life can still bring us up short and remind us that, you know, we're not all that, and that there are plenty of mysteries still waiting in the wings to remind us as a species that we are not the last word. Reality, that which doesn't change whether we believe in it or not, isn't going away. For all of our barking, the train keeps going, with or without us. Now, one of the ways that we could respond to a set of ideas or a reflection like that is by deciding that our understanding of reality is the only right one, that we've got a corner on what the train is, how it works, and how to make sure we're on board. All right. Now, depending how your imagination intersects with things like metaphors, you already know that I believe that every metaphor fails at some point. I think I might have just pushed this metaphor over the brink because, frankly, I can't imagine the dogs actually caring about getting onto the train, which I just suggested was important. They just want to run and bark. Maybe just want to run and bark is the equivalent of humans that could care less about reality and just want to keep the noisy party going. Because, hey, you know, life is short, and who really cares where the train's going anyway? We're not going to be there when it stops. But there does also seem to be some kind of shared human drive to try to know all we can about reality and to do what we can to cooperate with it, to live in accord with, in cooperation, in sync with it. Perhaps we could say that ignoring the train increases the danger of getting run over by it, at which point our hubris is revealed for the profound ignorance or lack of perspective that it is, and also at that point, it's too late. Because we've been flattened by reality at that point. The party is over. Our barking is silenced. Ouch. And yes, I do know that I have left the cat people to come up with their own metaphor, which I expect may start showing up in the chat box on the side of my screen momentarily. But you can't blame me because I didn't make up the finished saying, right? This is not my metaphor. But back to that decide we have a corner on reality idea for a moment. There's nothing new about someone deciding that they've got reality figured out and letting people know as much. One of the predictable results is that those people that agree are drawn to one another, and in short order, we have a group of like-minded people convinced that they've got this life thing figured out and that it's their mission to let everyone else know so others can also enjoy the benefits of having their future secured by accepting the group's understanding of right belief. So, as I've said, that's not new. What's new, perhaps, or at least recent, is having powerful algorithms sort of putting the super boosters on this process. To reference that dog and train metaphor, it's like amplifiers for the barking. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that point because I think we're awash in it. One of the fairly predictable results of a process like this is that our culture begins to fragment into groups. And depending on the power and influence of those groups, many of them would see themselves as collectively as embattled minorities, at odds with everybody else, but heroic in the process because they are right. And from that kind of a perspective, you can play the victim card pretty much whenever you want, and you can legitimize it all as a sort of David and Goliath story, sort of a look at us, the poor underdogs. I was going to say the dogs are back again, you know. But don't worry, in the end, we will laugh last because everyone will see that we're right. They will have to acquiesce to our version of the story of reality. I've been part of groups that perceive themselves this way, and I can tell you that in my experience, sometimes it feels pretty good, especially if we believe reality, which in religion land we typically call God, is on our side. What often goes missing in this story is the acknowledgement that we can't sum up reality. Reality is bigger than we are, beyond who we are, more powerful than we are, and frankly, more than a little bit mysterious. And at the same time, it's as obvious and undeniable as the train speeding through the middle of town. You ever wonder what a dog thinks a train is? Probably not, right? But remember, in this metaphor, we're the dogs. What if we imagine it this way? What the dogs think the train is what we might call worldviews. Not very flattering of our often much cherished worldviews, remember, this is a perspective thing. We're not the train, okay? Our worldviews are the ways that we think about, the ways that we understand, the ways that we interact with reality. They help us understand it. And when they're doing a good job, they can help us live in accord with it. They can help us know how to interact with reality and have some grip on our place in it. We don't all have the same vantage point or the same reactions to reality. To go back to that metaphor, some of us run and jump and bark. Some of us just stand there and bark. Some of us run and don't bark. Some of us maybe just, you know, crack one eye open and twitch an ear because we're upset when reality infringes on the long nap that we were enjoying. In any case, reality is going to keep barreling ahead. So we might want to consider what we can do to live in ways that line up with that. I want to introduce us today to a worldview perspective that I'm guessing most of us won't have spent a lot of time with, and one that has been consciously and deliberately assembled with the goal of living in accord with reality very much in mind. I mentioned this last week. It's a worldview that some would call sacred realism or evidential mysticism, and you can already tell that we are headed for a land where black and white thinking isn't going to rule the day, where either or isn't going to have the last word, because we've already got a mashup of terms that don't usually cohabitate, terms like sacred and realism or evidential and mysticism, maybe particularly that last one, fairly powerful sort of, these don't usually arrive together. Now, just to help us get our heads around this, what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of outline the big pieces of this kind of a worldview, and I'm going to do that using religious language that many of us in this community might be familiar with, but probably not familiar with having it applied to these ideas in this way. And let me just say once again, this is not an attempt to offer a worldview that is the last word on reality. It's the vantage point of yet another pooch running alongside the train and barking out their take on it, although that part of the metaphor is going to morph a little bit as we go, so stay posted for that. So, by way of outlining this, if you or I thought of ourselves as evidential mystics, we might say that reality is our God, evidence is our scripture, big history is our creation story, ecology is our theology, integrity is our salvation, and ensuring a just and healthy future is our mission. We wouldn't believe that we have it all dialed in. That's part of the integrity piece. We would know that we cannot honestly claim to have it all figured out. That's part of what taking the evidence seriously leads us to believe. And that's not least of all because there's new evidence about reality pouring in pretty much every moment of every day at this point in history, and a lot of it is pointing to the fact that we can't even pretend to understand all the implications of what we already know, never mind what we don't or can't know. So as I suggested, most of the religious images in that summary are the ones that many of us might find familiar. Ideas like God and scripture, creation stories, theology, salvation, mission. We might have grown up around those terms. We might have grown up, you know, soaking in them. The odds are pretty decent that most of us didn't grow up immersed in something like what is represented by the label big history. And I'm not going to take the time to unpack that more thoroughly here. What I'll do is I'll put up a link to a very fine summary of what that view is that's offered by one of its primary thinkers and advocates, a scholar and a proud grandfather named David Christian. The grandfather part will make sense if you take time to watch the video. I'll put that link up when I'm done here at the in the Facebook group. Very compact version of big history is this. Our species, humans, in the last few hundred years, have destabilized a climate system that has existed for several million years. We have created weapons that could obliterate most of the biosphere within 24 hours. We have depleted the biomass, the collective mass of living organisms of this planet, by around 50%. Staggering statistic. And again, we've done this primarily in the last, 300 years or so. In other words, for the first time in history, our human activities have become one of what Christiane calls the thresholds of increasing complexity. Our human activities have become one way of understanding how the universe builds things and also how things come apart. And Christiane quotes Martin Rees, who is a renowned astronomer, preeminent astronomer of our time. And he says it this way in his book called On the Future. Our Earth is 45 million centuries old. But this century is the first one in which one species, ours, can determine the biosphere's fate. And it's that general line of thought and of evidence that has many people referring to this period of history as the Anthropocene, which is basically a proposed geological epoch that would begin with the significant human impact on Earth's geology and ecosystems. So like lots of epoch dating it, that's a bit of a, you know, it's not like 1232 on January the 7th. It's not that precise. It's big thinking, hence big history. Back to our dog and train metaphor. With this in mind, you could say we're still the dogs barking at the train, but now, instead of being the local mutts, we've become a collective but less benign version of something more like Clifford the Big Red Dog. Now, when we bark, things move. How they move is, in no small part, up to us. Let me see if I can kind of bring this home a little bit for today with one further reference to the argument that David Christiane sets out in his summary of Big History. In the last third of the video that I'll put up the link to, Christiane talks about the importance of what he calls framing stories. And that's a theme that comes up fairly often in our explorations here at the table. I've often used the word mythology or the phrase guiding stories to reference this same set of ideas, stories that help us frame reality. Christiane talks about the work of Isaac Newton and how his education, which was set in England of the 17th century, was grounded in the Christian origin story. And Newton, of course, goes on to become this tremendously influential physicist and mathematician and theologian, quite a sophisticated theologian. Some have described Newton as, quote, the culminating figure of the scientific revolution. And as David Christiane says, Newton learned that origin story at home and at school and at university. And it gave him his understanding of his place in the universe. It gave him a framework that helped to tie all of his knowledge together and to put it into the sort of order that not only made sense to him, but that helped others who also knew that framing story to access it as well. Now, this to me, that's, you know, that again, that could seem like dusty history. I think history is only dusty if we sort of don't dust it off and realize its impact on the present. But check this out. Newton once described the universe. So let's say reality. Newton once described the universe as, quote, the sensorium of being incorporeal, living and intelligent. That's his description of the universe. The sensorium of being incorporeal, living, and intelligent. There's a couple of words in there that we might not throw around in casual conversation that often, and they're important to what we're exploring. So I'm just going to unpack it a little bit. Sensorium would be one of those. Sensorium means the apparatus of an organism's perception considered as a whole. So our sensorium would be all of our perception, all of our ability to perceive considered as a whole. That would be our sensorium. And he's describing the universe with this term. He's describing the universe as being the sensorium of, and then the of is this phrase of being incorporeal. Corporeal might be a more familiar word since it can be used to describe us as humans. That word just means relating to a person's body, especially as opposed to their spirit. Interesting definition for lots of reasons. So it's not really any kind of a surprise that incorporeal means not composed of matter, having no material existence. In other words, no body. No body. So what we've got here in this quote from Newton is someone steeped in the traditional Christian story describing the universe essentially as the body of a being that is not composed of matter. The apparatus of perception of a being that is not comprised of matter. And being, the word being in that quote, because Newton is a 17th century Christian, is capitalized. It's a proper noun. It's the name of a person, place, or thing. But not a thing like we're a thing. A being incorporeal, he says, whose apparatus of perception is the universe, of which we are a part, and which is made of the same stuff as us. In other words, in Newton's understanding, among other things, our species is part of the apparatus of an incorporeal being's sensing of everything. Just got to let that perk for a little bit, right? And yet, as is increasingly undeniably the case, the universe is a place in which we play a unique part, in the sense that while there is a reality that we typically think of as not us, we are having an impact on the whole on a scale that was not the case before this period of human history. And in order to deal with that reality, in order to deal with our big dog status in this tale of our time, we need a framing story that takes those realities into account. Newton and traditional Christianity, we could suggest, started us down that path. That framing story certainly worked for Newton and for those of Newton's time. But, as with Newtonian physics, many parts of which seem to be practically true, but which don't cover off adequately things we're learning in realms like quantum, that previously adhered to framing story is no longer adequate. When it cohered, it helped to support and it helped to make meaning of many things we all benefit by. To pick an easy example, if you've had the benefit of modern medicine and the care of that any time in your life, you have enjoyed one of those benefits. When we drive our cars, for example, we enjoy one of those benefits. Recently had occasion to fly somewhere, talk about applied physics. However, that framing story has also been the frame that supported things like the incredibly destructive project of colonialism, and provided, and in many cases continues to provide, the justification for things like just runaway resource depletion and extraction. And it did all of that in big, powerful ways, ways that moved us collectively as a species into this role, into this influence that we have now, not over just things like, you know, vague things like the economy, but on what we've been referring to in our explorations the last couple of weeks as reality. That framing story, that traditional framing story, can no longer hold all the pieces of what we know together. It no longer takes reality as we can see and experience it fully into account, any more than Newtonian physics, for example, fully takes into account what we've learned since then about the physical nature of our universe. That's an interesting intersection, and it can be a pretty complicated one. Trained as many of us are in the world of either or, we could come to an acknowledgement like that, if we do come to such a thing, if that resonates for us, and decide that the only way to proceed is to dismantle and then burn in a heap, you know, just to do away with that entire previous framing story. And for some of us, that's going to be the path. It's also possible, and this is what I was sort of attempting to gesture toward when I said there's many benefits that have come from the way the world cohered during the last 200, 300 years under that traditional Christian story. There's also a kind of intersection where we can stay present to wrestling with the complexity of the good things that we enjoy that are in part at least the fruit of the strength of that framing story and how well it worked for the power holders for sure during a big chunk of history and gave us the impetus that from which came things like the Industrial Revolution and the Scientific Revolution, and also be inadequate to embrace what we are learning about reality and what we know about reality now. Hence, something like evidential mysticism. A worldview that attempts to get to sort of get to a 30,000 foot level, to get up high enough to be able to see what the different pieces are that we're trying to have play well together in our understanding, to see what the different pieces are, to see how they interrelate, how they interact, what they have to do with one another, and to try to find a way to frame that whole story that helps us make sense of all those different sort of disciplines and experiences and pieces of knowledge, so we don't end up being fractured people, never mind bifurcated, not just split in half, just fragmented people for whom we have to suspend entire parts of our system of belief when we go to another realm. This is, for example, how we get to things like, the idea that religion is the enemy of science, right? It's that kind of like, I got to use one framing story over here, I have to use another framing story over here. It's pretty hard to live a whole, intact, thriving life when we're doing that. When, especially sometimes those framing stories just crash into one another and then we feel like we have to choose between them. And what evidential mysticism or sacred realism is a person's attempt to come up with a way to frame the whole thing that can help elevate both the evidential work of science, the information that's coming to light and coming in, and the mystery of things that often have religions made around them and from them. That there might be a way to, there might be a frame that's actually sort of adequate, big enough, expansive enough might be a better way to think of it, so it's not static, to hold both those things in high regard, each for their own strengths and their own contributions to the whole story of reality and how we can and should and must at this point live with it. Well, that's a lot to kind of try to collect together, but I would say that that kind of thinking, we could say, is why, among other things, we need to keep on exploring what we believe. And for good or for ill, perhaps, that is just what we're going to do. We're going to do that day by day, each of us, as we move ahead on our own journeys, and we're going to continue to do it collectively here at the table as we travel together. My hope, which I would share with Judy and I know with many others in this community, is that there's a way to do that, demanding, I think sometimes very demanding, but a way to do that that can be infused with love, first, last, most of all, with love. Also with sort of the pieces that we break out when we're trying to describe the actions of a thing like love, pieces like forgiveness, pieces like curiosity. Pieces like grace for those whose experience of running along, embarking at the train of reality is different than ours. Place for things like logic, for the rational. Place for things like mysticism, for the mysterious, for the spiritual. And in fact, I would say of the spiritual, in many ways, spiritual and love are things that I would sort of say those kind of play the same. Those kind of are. It's kind of our big encompassing ideas that can contain all those other ideas, even when they're not playing nice together, and help us continue to do the work of traveling forward together as a species in ways that can not just help us survive the reality I just described, but perhaps even thrive in the midst of doing the necessary work of living well with reality, living in accord with reality. So we're going to keep on exploring because it's what we do. That's it for now. I'm going to leave it there. We'll continue our exploration next week. Peace, everybody. Bye for now.